Hi, Dan. Hi, Jason.
Oh, you know, I staked out. I was thinking about writing novels, writing fiction, because I've seen you struggling this week on Twitter working on something. And I staked out Friday morning to work on the book that I wrote a manuscript of, and it's been sitting, and I would really like to revise it and have it be either done and sold or released or killed. Something just
those,
done.
Those are the options.
I just done.
Yep.
And
yep, I feel that.
And I came to a low point this morning, although I actually think it may be good. I've been very slowly rewriting chapters and thinking about, you know, and sort of gradually moving things around of like this, you know, I have a subplot that needs to change pretty dramatically and another thing that needs to kind of have a bunch of characters moved around. And this morning I was kind of like moving in Scrivener. I've got every chapter as an item and it's in the little binder view where you're dragging things around. It's like it's an outline and it's got my original notes from when I was outlining it before I wrote it. So they're not quite right. Which is part of the confusion. It's like it says this thing happens. I'm like, that's not actually what happens in that chapter, but that's what I thought was going to happen in that chapter. And right. I'm dragging things around, like thinking about the structural issues. And I realized that I have completely lost the thread because when I'm in Scrivener in that view, I'm either down in the weeds of like writing chapters, rewriting chapters, or I'm looking at this weird outline that's not quite right. And I had that moment this morning where I actually opened up Omni Outliner and decided I'm basically going to tear it back to nothing and try to build a new outline and use the chapters and use the parts. But I realized I reached the point where I can't just kind of slide chapters around and change names and stuff. Like it's all going to break apart. And if I'm really not confident in parts of the plot, spackling them is not a solution. Yeah, well, I need to tear it apart and put it back together.
I wrote a blog post about this a while back. I think it's gone though, because I think it was on my old blog and I hadn't re-imported that stuff. But to me, the dichotomy of editing is, I call it the spiderweb versus the forge, which is, when you feel like when you get to that point, that low point, and I've been there where it's like, oh man, this is so
none of this makes sense anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And you feel like, oh, it's like this fragile spider web, right? I start plucking at pieces and it all just falls apart. And sometimes that's true. Sometimes I think it's also an illusion because it's just like of our perspective and where we are standing when we are looking at it. And on the flip side of that, I think when editing is really at its best, it's like a forge, right? Where you hammer away at something and it feels relentless and it feels tiring and all of that. But what you ultimately end up with is something that is much stronger than what you began with. And it's the tough part is figuring out like what situation you're in, right? Like, is this something that needs to be ripped down to the studs, or is there like kind of smaller work that I can do throughout that will actually make it stronger, even if it just feels like, oh man, I am just like plugging holes left and right, right? Like I'm got my finger in the dike and I'm trying to hold back the water.
Yeah, I have, I think also because I've left this so long that I don't have like mastery of every single move that I made. Like I've forgotten some of the stuff because it's been so long. And, you know, so I can't just kind of like flick a little tiny bit here and there and be like, aha, I fixed it. I can't debug this because to use a programming metaphor, like, I can't debug this at this point because I don't have enough familiarity with the source anymore, the source code. It is a little too abstracted from that. But I do know the big picture, both what happens and also what all the issues are. And that's what's gotten me to think, I think the best way to do this is actually to kind of like walk. I want to walk through what I think the story should be. Because I know that there are parts of the story that are not what I want the story to be. And I think that might allow me to kind of work through. Also, it's been so long that it'll allow me to work through some things and throw some stuff away, which I suspect is what I need to do. Part of this was I was moving some chapters out into a cut folder of like that. That's just going to go because there's things I need to compress and move around. And I had a moment where I thought, you know, one way to do this would be to ask myself through this Omni Outliner document, ask myself what I want the story to be. And really like go through that process to the point where if some stuff that I've written or that I wrote 5 years ago or whatever, longer, falls out, so be it, right? Like, it's not a big deal to me because I don't, my so much time has passed that giving up my precious words of 7 years ago or whatever, it doesn't matter. Sure. I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, it gets, the longer you take away from something, the less emotional involvement you have in it. And generally, that is good because when it comes to editing, it's not that you shouldn't, you know, care about it, but like, there's a dispassionate nature that helps with that. And I think, you know, you often hear the advice, the kill your darlings advice.
Yep.
And I saw some good clarification on that. I don't remember who it was, but one of the writers I follow on Twitter was talking about this recently, which is like, doesn't mean getting rid of the good stuff, right? The stuff you really like, right? It means getting to a point of realizing that your emotional attachment to something outweighs its utility.
Right.
Like, obviously, if you get rid of all the good stuff, then you're just throwing out stuff that's actually good. And I think that's the thing a lot of people struggle with, is that idea like, wait, you want me to throw out the stuff I really like? No, don't throw out the stuff you really like. Throw out the stuff that you kind of know you really like, but at the same time, you also really know it doesn't work.
Yes.
Like, and you can tell the difference. It just takes like some self-examination.
Well, and every time you pull out, like when you've written 2,000 words and it's fresh and you pull it out and say, I'm not going to use it, it hurts.
Yeah.
When it's 2,000 words that you wrote 6 years ago, who cares? Or 3 years ago or whatever. Sure. Who cares?
I mean, even a year or two. I mean, I was doing an edit of a manuscript that I finished last year, the year before that. And, you know, this was a manuscript I gave to my agent. And he read it and he's like, I think this needs to be shorter. And I was like, okay. He's like, how long is it? I was like, oh, it's around 96,000 words, which is fairly, I mean, my first book was like 120K, uh-huh. Like, so much longer. But I'd aimed for a shorter book, and originally when I started writing this, I was like, 80K seems like a good benchmark. It ended up being 96, so a bit longer. almost a quarter again as long. And so I started going through it and pulling stuff out, thinking, you know, I'm going to try to get it down a couple thousand words here or there. And when I finished my pass and got all the way through it, I realized I was like, I had pulled almost 10,000 words out of it. Like, in I don't think the story is any worse for it. Like, a lot of it was even just like pulling out like little lines, sentences or paragraphs here and there, right? It wasn't like I cut a whole chapter and was just like done. But it was just like removing enough cruft and other junk to make it flow more smoothly. And also getting to that point of realizing that things that I really enjoyed might actually be distractions or digressions,
right,
that hold it back rather than moving everything forward.
Yeah, because in the moment when you're writing too, a lot of it is like, oh, I've got these characters, I'm going to play with them. It's like picking up toys and playing with them. And then when you get some perspective on your work, in when you're writing this stuff, you look at it and you're like, why is that there?
That's not a load-bearing scene.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun to play with it. I was just looking at that. There's a scene that I was looking at the other day that I wrote. That is, I mean, it's cute, I guess, about one of the characters. I wanted to have a woman. She's a young woman. I wanted to show her. I wanted her to be centered in the scenes. There's this kind of nerdy boyfriend she's got who is kind of an actor in the plot. And I wanted to show a bunch of stuff about like her thought process and how she manages him and how she's thinking about like, are they going away for a weekend drive, or are they going to end up staying somewhere, and what does that mean about their relationship? And I thought like I liked it for the fact that I was really trying to express that character and let her have those thoughts and have the scene be centered around what this woman thinks, because I think that's important. I want to have women in key parts of the story and let them be present as people. But I look back on that and I'm like, but this is pointless. Like, it's great that it's there, in the sense that it was like me doing the work of thinking about what she's thinking, but I cut it all, almost all of it. And now it's left with kind of like, there's like a little fraction of her thinking about it. And she's got some dialogue that indicates, to me at least, that she's thinking about these issues. But the like the detailed kind of inner monologue of that character, I looked at it and I was like, well, this is more like I was doing research on my character.
Right.
And then I see it in a chapter and I'm like, no. Mm-mm, no, right? Like, and I could do that now because, again, like, it was a good thing to do it, but that doesn't mean it's good to have it in the story.
You know what's great about that example you just gave is I think it's also a better illustration of another old saw in the writing advice books, which is the show don't tell thing, right? And there's an interesting like conflict there a lot of times because, you know, people tell you all the time, show, don't tell, right? Like, give the idea of this without like blatantly saying it. And sometimes I find that when you do something like that, where you have something that's very telly, like a monologue or an internal thoughts and stuff like that, and it can serve to giving you a better idea, like you just said, of where that character is coming from, which actually makes it easier for you to then rewrite the scene and convey it in a way that is perhaps more showing than telling. So that's actually helpful. It doesn't mean go remove every single place that you tell the audience something, because that, again, that's not how that works, but it does help you get a clearer idea. And I think that's a real benefit there. And you're right. When you're writing, like, it's a totally different part of the brain. It's a totally different process than when you're editing or rewriting. And it's less fun in some ways, but like it also, I actually find editing and rewriting frustrating, but refreshing at times, because it can feel very demanding to sit down and be like, now I shall create spontaneously out of nothing. Like, there's a lot of pressure in that. And it can be hard. I've been struggling with that recently. Like, and so being able to go and rework on old things and sort of like take a more analytical view, it helps exercise a different part of the brain that's connected to that creative part, but isn't just like, I've got to come up with something out of nothing right now.
Yeah. They're totally different. And, you know, editing and creating are different things. They're different things. And, doing it, you know, editing your own stuff is a challenge.
Yeah.
And that's why you end up having to put, like Stephen King says, you got to put it in a drawer for a little while and then get it back out, because you gotta have that gap to give it some perspective.
Divorce yourself from it a little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so far divorced from this thing now that I kind of need to put the pieces back together and do some triage on it. But I think this is funny, and this is a segue into computer things, by the way, is nothing makes me want to pick up this book that I wrote that is kind of about all the creepy things about Google more than when Google does creepy things in public. And the funny thing about it is, since I started writing this, there is always something creepier. That's the thing that gets me, is like, there are things in this, because it's about the Google of 7 years ago or whatever.
There's no upper limit on creepiness.
That since then, the number of creepy things that they've done or tried to do, it just keeps going and going and going. And that's one of the things that I will have to do as a part of refactoring this thing and putting together a new plot. And some of the stuff that I'm specifically choosing to upgrade and change is about, like, what do I think about Google now? Which is different, but the idea here is also to be kind of satirical about, like, the tech industry in general. Google is a good example. It's kind of like fits the stereotype in a lot of ways. I need to keep that stuff updated, and I've been taking notes of all the creepy things they do. Again, it's not meant to be like an incisive, like a scabrous tell all about Google. It really is more sort of satirical about how a lot of tech industry stuff is dehumanizing, and they don't treat their workers particularly well, and they don't really think about the consequences of their actions. And those are like constant refrains, not just from today, but like all the way back to classic science fiction of the 19th century, right? Like, this is a recurring thing about the creator not understanding the creation and potentially being destroyed by it. Hello, Frankenstein, right?
Yeah, go back all the way to the beginning there.
But that moment when Google at I/O did their amazing tech demo of the Google Assistant pretending to be a person and talking to real people and scheduling appointments, where I had that sort of secondary thing, and I mentioned this at Six Colors in a couple of places, that secondary thought of, like, at what point did people say, hey, putting a lot of engineering effort into pretending to be human suggests that what we're going to do here is try to get away with something and pretend that this is a person and not disclose that it's a robot calling, I know it's not actually a robot, John Siracusa, a robot calling other people. And nobody was like, I don't think maybe we should pretend to be human if we're not. And I was like, here we go again. I got more grist for the mill of that book that I can't, can't rewrite.
Well, yeah, you mix it around a little bit. You let it marinate with some other stuff, and then you project forward again, right? Like, well, what if they did do that and didn't tell anybody? And like, yeah, what if that whole keynote had actually been an AI?
It is
an interesting question. I think Google does exemplify more than a lot of tech companies the, like, we can do it, so we should do it mentality. And I remember this coming up years ago. I don't remember what it was, but it had something to do with them, like, scanning for Wi-Fi hotspots or something, right? Like, there was some big thing, I think it was in Europe maybe, where they like were scanning a bunch of Wi-Fi hotspots. Probably, I don't know if that ended up being part of what they used for like location data or whatever. But anyways, it was one of those things that you clearly saw was like, oh yeah, this is totally feasible and we can get a lot of great information out of this. But they did not think for a second how it would look and how people would feel about that. And technology companies as a whole are not always the best with how people feel about it. I think Apple tends to get it right more than other companies, but they're certainly not infallible in that department either. And I don't know. It's one of those, like, I totally get that. Again, it's like, you know what it is? It's a little bit like the distinction we were just talking about between writing and editing, right? When you're developing something, coming up with all these cool ideas, you're like, oh, we could do this and we could do this and that would let us do this. And like, you're in that creative state where there's no bad ideas, right? Like,
right.
You just need to get stuff down. You need to get stuff done. But what they seem to lack is that thoughtful rewriting editing thing where they go back and look at what the things they've come up with and they say, that's a good idea. But if we do that, that opens the door to this and that, that could be
right.
problematic.
Could we do this? Yes, we could do this. Although I will say, tech people, software people, always say yes to could we do this. That's
sure.
Something I've learned. Yeah. They always say
I got very careful when I worked in software development because our people, when I worked at the small research program, and our director would always come in and be like, oh, could we do this? And we realized, yes, if we said yes, then he would have us do it every time. And so what we started telling him was like things were just not feasible, which is to say, it's not that we can't do this. It's that either we shouldn't or the
right.
amount of time and energy that would go into that mean it's a dumb idea.
And that's that extra layer. That's that super ego above you saying, while we could do this, it's not a good idea that we do this. And
right.
I have worked with very talented software developers who never met a project that they didn't feel that they could do. And the problem there is they only can do like two projects. And we would come and say, we have these 15 things we need to do. And they're like, well, we'll do them all. It's like, no, you won't. So what are we going to do? And you know what? There's not as much... You know, building X is never going to be as exciting as writing little glue code to attach to an open source project or to a cloud database or cloud service, right? Never going to mm-hmm. be as hot, never going to be as burnishing to your ego as a programmer. But it's and that's the challenge if you're a manager of that stuff is like, just because they say, just because they can do it, you know, let's think it through. And with Google, I do see a lot, because they do have to this day, an engineering-driven culture, a lot of like, isn't it amazing what we can do? And again, yeah, yes, that was an amazing demo. It's amazing. But at what point did somebody say, you should make a lot of effort to make software that pretends to be human so that it'll fool other people because that's a product, and that nobody said, do we want to do that? Do we want to hack human beings with our software? Is that where we are? And I think it says something about this one impulse of Google And other tech companies too. I think I think Google's a really strong proxy because in some ways they are the most unfiltered, and so we can see it. I think this exists everywhere, but I think in Google it has a higher chance of coming out, right? Where you're like, aha, there. That's that impulse that we that is everywhere, but we see it from Google. Like, should we do this? It's like doesn't crop up, or maybe it crops up sometimes, but some of this stuff still escapes. And like, even if they saw this project and killed it or said, no, you need to scale it back. The fact is, like, somebody did all this work to insert uptalk and ums and uhs and pauses and like colloquial, non-committal phrases and things in order to fool a person. So somebody was like, I could totally fool a person with a Google Assistant with just a few tweaks. It's like, all right, but why? Why are you doing that? And it's like fundamentally to deceive them is the answer. And nobody thought that was a problem because it gets us what we want, which is access to this person's calendar from the Google Assistant. Like, that's nobody said maybe deception, fundamentally building software for the purposes of deception is something we should think about. Like, oh, well,
you know, it's interesting, too, because I can also imagine, you know, to give them the benefit of the doubt in some cases. Like, I can imagine why a lot of people thought this was a great idea, not just from a product perspective, but from like, I don't know, I don't like talking to the phone on the phone to people
either.
Agree. Like, and I bet there are a bunch of engineers at Google who are like, man, I hate talking on the phone. I wonder if we could solve that. And again, like you said, they came up with a really clever example, but they didn't really think about the way that it impacted everything else. Now, the thing that's interesting to me about this is that even if Google, and they've now, I think, said or confirmed that they're going to use some way of like alerting people that they're talking to a robot. I don't know what that's going to look like. I don't know if that will hamper this technology in general. But the problem is now that Google's done it, the genie is out of the bottle. This is going to be a thing.
Oh,
right?
Sure. Like, I mean, it's already a thing with some robocalls and all that. This
exactly.
is just some of the best programmers in the
next
world
level,
doing
right?
This.
Like,
yeah.
And even if Google doesn't do it now, other companies who probably have fewer scruples are going to do it down the road.
But what this is, and this is for people, it's funny. I mean, it never fails. I wasn't surprised by this. It never fails that there's somebody who will, when you criticize something that happens in technology, will say, it's fine. You're too sensitive. I got one of those. I got a you're too sensitive guy. And it's like, now, actually, this is not just the time where the genie gets out of the bottle. This is the time where we as a society, as a culture, say, you know what? It's not okay for computers to pretend to be people. We should all agree that if it's a voice interface that is not that can sound exactly like a person and you didn't trigger it, they're engaging with you, so you don't know that it needs to say that it's a computer interface. And that if you don't do that, you're doing something unethical. And will people do? I mean, again, this is another one of these ridiculous arguments. Like, but yeah, but some people will be unethical. Of course, some people will be unethical.
Sure.
But
yeah.
You know how we know they're unethical? We have ethics, and we all agree that this is unethical. And then when they do it, we can say, you shouldn't do that. We can go to our legislatures and say, that sort of behavior should be illegal. Phone spammers, you know, or it's like a disclosing that I'm recording a phone call,
sure.
Right? It's like basic stuff, but now's the time to have the conversation about that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely. I think this is going to get more and more interesting, I think. Not just this area, but a lot of areas like this, because we've entered this age where the technology for essentially deceiving people is just incredible. I mean, I listened to a year ago or something, I was listening to a Radiolab episode where they talked about, and this has been shown in a couple different places now, but this technology where they can alter essentially video and audio to basically make anybody sound like they're saying anything, right? Like video that legitimately looks perfectly fine, but is totally like synthetic based off of existing video of people, for example. And, you know, we've had to exercise over the years, we've had to exercise the idea that like things, we can't trust certain things like photographs, right? Photographs, doctoring photographs has become commonplace, right? Almost every photograph you see is touched up in some way or another. And we're hitting that point where we felt like, okay, you can't trust photos, but like if I see video of something, I know it's real, right? And now we are hitting a point where we can't trust that, to the point where now we're starting to worry about people on the phone that we can't tell if they're people or not. And at a certain point, I mean, here's your far future science fiction premise, is like, at a certain point, will you be able to trust like reality, right? Like, will you be able to like know that this is kind of like your Westworld thing, right? Where it's like, will I be able to know that the person I'm talking to is not a person, but a robot,
right?
And you know, I think that's it's terrifying on the one hand. Like, I think that is a legitimately scary thing, because not just like because of the threat of it, but like there's sort of an ontological issue there, right? With the whole idea of like, can I even trust what I'm seeing, what I'm experiencing as a person now? And this is just another step in that direction.
Yeah.
And you're totally right. Like, the ethical nature of it is something that should be discussed and debated. And what worries me is that the majority of people either will be apathetic or will actively say, no, there's no problem with this.
Yeah, well, it's convenient. I had somebody say, well, the argument, and they ended up saying, I think seriously, like, oh, they saw my point at the end of this conversation on Twitter. But, you know, their argument was, I was like, yeah, but this is deceptive. And what their response was, yeah, but they have to do this because otherwise they're not going to get the people on the other end of the phone to play ball. And I said, what you just said is, I need to lie to get what I want.
Yeah,
it's not okay. And he was like, I see your point. Like, and again, it's like, I get it. I totally get it. Also, we are entering, I've seen people call it like the post-truth era. We are entering a point, what I would say is, where people can't, things they don't see with their own eyes in person aren't, they can't validate. And that's hard, right? Because we have lots of things that evidence that we previously counted as evidence. Now it's very hard to do that. And I'll bring up, again, not trying to go down a rabbit hole here, but a lot of people talking about this concept of fake news, right? Mm-hmm. Well, what does that statement mean when it's used by people in power to refer to things about them that are written by, let's say, journalists who believe it to be true? What it says is that we are living in an era where not only can people fabricate things so that they look true, and that, you know, put Google's voice technology and deep fake video of John Legend, and now we can make John Legend say anything we want, right? Because we've got that. We've got his voice from the Google assistant.
We got that
video. Thanks, John Legend. You know, he's going to say whatever we want now. But the flip side of that is also true, which is anything you do say that you want to deny, you just say it's a fake, and no one can prove you wrong.
It's plausibility, right? Like, it's all plausible deniability, and that's what we've done. We've opened the door to reasonable doubt in pretty much any circumstance by saying that anything can be manufactured, right? And like, that's, you know, that enters very quickly enters conspiracy theorist territory too, right? Like, oh, the moon landing videos were faked, right? Like, yeah, you as a enthusiast for space travel have probably encountered any number of those things. And when you get to an issue where like, oh wow, like pretty much anything can be synthesized, like, it's hard to argue back against that, right? Because like, your logic and your brain tell you one thing, but like, people who want to believe outlandish things are never going to be convinced no matter what.
The positive part of this, and this is me trying to be optimistic, is that it means you have to reason. I mean, that's the bottom line. Is it means that instead of just seeing a picture and going, I guess it's real, you actually have to think about the facts and use logic. Now, the moon hoaxers and the flat earthers have their own complex chains of logic that lead them to believe that things are true that are provably untrue. And that is a problem. And that's one of the challenges of this world, is getting people to use reason and to understand facts and to sort of choose people and verify them as kind of having expertise, because nobody can be an expert on anything. And there's a lot of pushback where people are like, why? Like, Brexit, I think people were like, well, all the economists say this is going to be bad for Britain, but I don't believe the elites. I think it's going to be fine. It's like, no. Literally, the people who spend their entire lives studying this, think it's a bad idea. You don't have to, they don't rule your country, but you might want to listen to them and factor that in when you're thinking of all the other different aspects of this thing you're voting on. You might want to think about the experts, and they're like, no, we don't trust the experts because they know things that are inconvenient, so we're just going to disregard them. And that's, well, I mean, global warming, climate change stuff is the same story. It's like, the science is clear. The science is clear, but people just don't want to believe it.
Right. So people have a tendency to over-prioritize their own personal experiences and knowledge over other
absolutely
people,
true,
even if their knowledge level is less. Right, like I walk outside and it's January and
it's cold,
you know,
it's a blizzard,
and I say there's no global warming.
Yeah.
Right, like it's freezing here.
Yeah, it's human. It's because we're you know, we're savanna dwelling you know, primates and then cave people later, and our brains evolved for stuff that we are not equipped, like this world isn't, our brains are not very good at a lot of things in this world, and that is a problem, and people can exploit it. I don't know what I'm saying is I need to rewrite my book.
that's the trouble, though, to bring it all the way back around is, you know, I think about this a lot with the whole, like, the old perfect is the enemy of good adage. And the point is, yeah, you probably do need to rewrite your book. But like, to a certain extent, there's also a point at which you have to do that let go thing, right? And say, because you could always rewrite that book. You could spend the next 5 years rehashing it. And, you know, the trouble is that the technology and everything else keeps moving along even then. So at a certain point, like, you know, you want to spend as much time hammering these things into shape as much shape as possible. But eventually you have to let them go into the world. And that's hard. And what's worse about that is, and I was thinking about this earlier, is you'll get to a point with a work where you have spent so much time with it that you loathe it. You just hate it. It's funny because, like, I spent so much time creating this and slaving over it and, like, just putting all of my energy and time into this, and I never want to look at it again. And it's a weird place to be.
Yeah, but I just
you definitely get there.
I've said for years that this thing, I just want to finish it, but it needs a rewrite, because it does. It needs a rewrite. And be like, oh, you know, that book you talked about, where is it? And it's like, well, it needs a rewrite, and I don't have time to rewrite it, so it's going to sit there, and I'm not going to release it as it is. And that's why I said, to bring it back around, I just want it to be over. But it's sitting here, and I'm not willing to just let it go. Because, I mean, the good news is, if we're having these conversations about tech companies and Google and things like that, that means that what the thing is about is still kind of what it's about, right? But I want to get through the other side and say, okay, I did it. I took my crack at it. Here it is. I feel like it's at a point where it could either go out or die. But then it will have reached that point. I just want to get it out of this interim state. And I'm not at the point where I want to just abandon it and write it off and say, I know those were 100,000 words that I wrote, but, you know,
Schrodinger's manuscript.
I'd like to give it another go, but we'll see, you know, how much time I can wall off for it. But at least this week I am inspired by
Google. I tell you, Jason, every once in a while, I think back to that trilogy that I made you read, that I first wrote.
Unfinished trilogy.
The unfinished trilogy. And I was thinking, like, I should finish that. And then I think, why?
No, actually, so I read, I don't know what you've read of mine, but so I wrote that book about the teenage superheroes. And it's like 150,000 words long. And I keep thinking about that one. That's my other option here is the book about the tech industry that is probably the right one for me to do, because given my background, it puts a spin on, like, selling it as a book to be like, oh, longtime tech writer writes novel criticizing, you know, thriller, techno thriller, whatever. There's some
marketing hook.
There's some marketing there. Right. But I keep thinking about the other thing. And I think, you know, that's probably in terms of raw material, that first thing that I wrote, I still think about it.
Sure.
I don't know if I would use a word of what's written.
Oh yeah.
Or whether I just write it again, knowing that I want to do it a little differently and having, you know, and the way it would be structured and a whole bunch of stuff, I might just write it again. And I thought about writing it as like a comic book script or as a screenplay or like all these other things too, because I kind of really like it. But it has reached that point where, like your thing, if you wanted to revisit that world, you'd probably start again and do a new take on what you did the first time, not write the third book where you're suddenly looking at the first two going, oh my God, I need to rewrite these two.
Yeah. That would be pointless. I mean, I think about every once in a while about like cannibalizing or cribbing stuff out of it for other stuff.
Sure.
But, like, I would not, like, I probably wouldn't do the whole thing again, whole cloth. I would probably just, like, snip things that I like out of it,
yeah,
because it just doesn't, it doesn't have, it needs, well, my it doesn't stand on its own two legs.
My 150,000 word thing, I mean, I would take the first, like, 60,000, 50,000 words and make it, like, a young adult novel that sure, they tend to be that length, short, and yeah, and with a cliffhanger, and I just kept writing, and there's a lot, and I thought, well, this is more like a comic book series or a series of books than it is a book, right. And it's big and unwieldy, and sort of, I think it's sort of set in, is it set in the 80s? I mean, it's like period, which is also weird, and I couldn't commit to the superhero premise, which is also weird about it. Like, while writing it, like, I never wanted to write that moment where I said, yes, these were superheroes and they wore costumes and capes and things and had right, superhero names, right, but I also kind of, like, never committed to them not being that. And it's one of those things that 10 years later, I'm like, yeah, I need to commit to, like,
yeah, that's making a decision is sometimes the hardest thing. Like, cause if you try, I realized this, I'm working on a manuscript recently, was I got to a point, where I was redoing something and I had my girlfriend read it, and she's like, I don't understand why this section is here. And I'm reading through it and I'm like, oh yeah, I know why that's there. It's because I thought that plot was going in one direction and I wasn't sure whether to go, yeah, in that direction or not. So I kind of hedged. Yeah. And you know what doesn't work in a book? Hedging.
Yeah. Well,
that is not,
I understand
a
it from a human nature standpoint, which is like, I was thinking, boy, you know, if I give everybody capes and tights, then I'm really committing to going down that route. And I'm not 100% sure I want to commit to it. So I'm not going to commit to it now, because if I do, it's going to be more work for me later to change it.
Right. Exactly.
The problem is that if you don't commit, it's still going to be more work for
it's
you
still work,
because
yeah,
you've hedged the whole way through, and you're going to have to go back and take all your hedges out and commit. So you might want to commit. I mean, the only, you know, and you can always go back and change it. Or in the true NaNoWriMo spirit, if you decide it's not working, just start writing it the other way and yep, figure yep, you'll backtrack and fix the earlier take. I've done that a bunch where I've been like, oh, I did this thing, I'm going to pretend I didn't do that thing and note it and fix it later and just keep writing forward. And that's a thing for all of you out there who might think about writing a book or something else. That is the best thing I learned from doing NaNoWriMo, is keep writing, because your brain is going to say, oh, you know, what I really want to do is, like, really fuss over this paragraph I just wrote and make this sentence perfect and change that thing. I'm going to change this character here, and so now I need to go back and find everything that character appears in earlier and change those too. Don't do it. That's what the second draft is for.
Yeah,
just keep writing forward. Change things if you need to. Keep writing forward. Don't stop, because you'll want to stop. Your brain will want you to stop, and then you're not writing anymore. And that's
you've,
oh, but I'm editing.
Flow.
No, you're, yeah, right. Once you're not writing anymore, you're not writing anymore. You might be editing, you're probably noodling, you're probably procrastinating, whatever you're doing, even if it's in your manuscript, you're not writing. So if you are, that's a little writing tip. So this has been Dan and Jason's writing podcast that we never did. Mixed in with a little technology.
Lots of good advice here.
Yes, and we missed last week, but we're back. So there, I'm back. I was gone. I was in Texas.
I was also gone.
And you were gone.
I was in California.
Yeah. So how about that? So, we couldn't do it, but we're back.
Yep,
back at home now.
We're back.
All right. Well, thanks to everybody for subscribing to Six Colors, and we'll be back. But until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.